I was going to tell you before you started, fellas, but I just thought I'd let you go in innocent. Good morning, my blood brothers, sisters and young people. We come now to a different phase in the experiences of this nation and in the ministry of the prophets, that of Elisha. Yesterday we saw that the dramatic events that Carmel and then Horeb had brought into the realization of Elijah the fact that one thing is needed usually when you're bringing people to salvation, and that is time. The instantaneous, dramatic, miraculous can have an impact. It can witness. It can confirm that there is a God and that he rules in heaven and earth. But when men and women are going to come to salvation, it takes time for their hearts and minds to be brought near to God. You see, we talk about the road to Damascus, but it wasn't really an instantaneous conversion of Saul on the road to Damascus, was it? That was the turning point. But his conscience and his mind had been at work for months, perhaps even years before that, preparing him for that moment. And one of the things we shall see this morning is that our time scales are not God's, fortunately. We live in an instant world, you know. You can have instant coffee, you can have instant hot meals, you can have almost instant anything, instant money out of machines. You know, we're in a world that can't wait. It wants everything now. It's got to have it, like, now. What do you mean next week, next year, 5 years' time? And the whole of society has changed because of that. I can remember when I started work, people used to go to negotiate their terms and conditions of employment, the unions, and I can remember as a young trainee manager sitting there, and people would talk about, well, of course, if you have this today, you know, it'll affect what happens for X years, and so let's negotiate sensibly and sort of plan through. And over the years it changed. People didn't care about tomorrow. What they said is, what we worry about is today. We want it now. No, we're not worried if in 5 years' time there's no factory. None of them come into it at all. Me. I want it now. And that's the world we live in. It's an instant world. You know, you take the photographs in and they're instantly back. You now don't even have to take your photographs in because, you know, there's someone wandering around here with an instant camera. Here you are. Click. There you are. And that's the world we live in. Things are done just like that. And that's the sort of mentality we adopt. But when you come to a relationship with God, you find God works differently. Because he knows that time is needed. And so it was that Elijah had to learn that lesson. He wanted that dramatic change in people's hearts that would then sort of send them on their way rejoicing. And perhaps I might be unfair when I say that, but you know that's often what happens with an evangelical conversion, isn't it? People are built up and their emotions are whipped up and they're lifted high and they go on their way, and within a few hours or days they're flat again. Because, you see, it takes time for the heart and mind to become attuned to the things of God. And so Elijah had to learn that it was by grace we are saved, and that grace was going to work out over a period of time. They'd had a drought for 3 years. They had this spectacular event on Carmel, but within a few hours, within 24 hours,
he realised that the people's hearts hadn't really changed. And so he's now got a companion. He's got Elisha. And Elisha is a different man. And the record doesn't tell us this, but the chronology is that they have to spend quite some time together. You know, when we read our Bibles, we sort of leap from this chapter into that chapter and we think it happens just like that. But it doesn't. You see, Elijah and Elisha are together for a considerable number of years. While both men adjust to the fact that God is working his way and not man's way. And so, as we said Monday night, the two men are different in appearance. The two men are different from background, and I suspect that the two men were different in temperament. We see that Elijah was this austere, strong, dominating man who had a commanding appearance, a man sort of apart from the crowd, who stood out, who was very much his own man, a man to be afraid of if you got on the wrong side of him. And here was Elisha, who presents us a different picture, a man of the people, a man who is now going to bring a different touch to what was going on in the nation. This isn't the man who's going to come in like the 410 Gale and absolutely decimate the opposition. This is a man who is going to move quietly among the people from one end of the country to the other, from north to south, from east to west. And wherever he goes, his voice will be heard, his touch will be felt, but a different result will be generated, because there is a remnant that are to be saved by grace. And so, when we look at the two men at work, we see straight away a contrast is developed, isn't it, in the very first act. You see, Elijah arrives and said, there shall be no dew nor rain these years according to my word. And then Elisha turns up, and the very first thing that happens when Elisha recrosses the Jordan and comes to Jericho is he gives life, he heals the water, he gives them living water that they might live. So the whole tenor changes now, the pace of activity changes, but this is still the same ministry. Because you remember back there in 1 Kings chapter 19 that the instruction to Elijah was quite specific. It said to him, thou shalt anoint Nimshi, Jehu the son of Nimshi, to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel Meholah shalt thou anoint to be a prophet in thy room. Now that's very specific wording. It wasn't just to be anointed a prophet, he was to be anointed a prophet in thy room. So it's the same work, it's the same ministry. The two men really are to be seen as one in the sight and purpose of God and of the people. But now it's a different lesson. We've seen the powerful witness that there is a God who rules in heaven and earth. And now we're seeing that this God of justice is also a God of love and a God of compassion. And so as we come down to this first list that we have here, we can see there's a slowing down of the pace. Now people are going to have time to reflect and adjust. So Elisha is a servant for 14 years. It's a long apprenticeship that he's going to serve. But think of all the things that Elijah and Elisha will be able to talk about. But Elisha has to learn that he's going to introduce this element of grace into the people's understanding. And he isn't going to go there confronting kings. and standing there in royal court. In fact, he's quite disparaging about the three kings when he stands in front of them when they go out to battle with Moab. He says, as far as I'm concerned, you don't really exist. If it wasn't for Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I wouldn't even bother talking to any of you. He's quite disparaging about that aspect of life. He's a man of the people. He's a man that moves among ordinary men and women. And so this man moves among the people and brings a different aspect of God's dealing with us to the fore.
I'll just put that up so we get some brief idea of where we're talking and moving. Here's, these are speculative, mind you, can't actually categorically state that Shulam is up there, and this might be Gilgal, it could be on the other side there, Bethel, Jericho, Samaria, Dothan. So you can see these are places which Elisha moves amongst, and it seems as though he moves up to here regularly. Now, chronology, as I've said earlier, in this particular aspect of scripture is very difficult, but just to show you that these things are not happening sort of instantly one after the other, I tried to put together there from Brother Edward Green's chronology work a sort of indication perhaps of the Shunammite woman. You see, in fact, although they occur in the chapters quite close, there's 20 odd years between when he first meets the Shunammite woman and between when you get the Shunammite woman's property restored. We're going to get another 7-year famine during the ministry of Elisha, and the ministry of Elisha lasts for 40 years. Now this is the difference between Elijah and Elisha. Elijah appears and there's this instant action, but it's 40 years. Now it's interesting, if it is actually 40 years, isn't it? You know, this is a biblical number which keeps reoccurring. But you can see there how that these things happen over a long period of time. When Elijah was on Carmel, on Horeb rather, and was given that instruction by God to actually appoint people to follow after him, if you sit down and work out the time scale involved, he was told to bring Hazael, then Jehu, and then Elisha into the work, wasn't he? Well, it's 17 years after Horeb before Hazael starts coming down and invading Israel. It's 30 years before Jehu actually finishes wiping out the house of Ahab. And the ministry of Elisha lasts for 40 years. And it's probably not going to start for another, you know, 14 years anyway. So you see suddenly how time is brought into this whole picture. God is very long-suffering. He's not willing that any should perish. Now, we know they wanted to get instant results. People do. The disciples of Jesus wanted instant punishment on these people, didn't they? Call down fire from heaven on them, they said. And Jesus said, you don't know what spirit you're of. Patience. Kindness. Long-suffering, gentleness. There's an interesting picture in Paul's writing to Timothy in regard to how the disciple of God should approach life in that sense. It's second epistle of Paul to Timothy, verse 24, chapter 2. Paul's second letter to Timothy, chapter 2, verse 24. And the servant of the Lord must not strive,
but must be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient, in meekness instructing those that oppose themselves. If God, peradventure, will give them repentance, the acknowledgement of the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will. This is the attitude that the servant of the Lord has to inculcate: to be gentle, apt to teach, patient. You know, we have more labor-saving devices in the world today than ever before, and we have less time. We have less time. You know, we have more things to save us time, and yet we have less time. And this is what God is telling us. People need time, and God's prepared to give us time. Time to come to a knowledge of Him. Time to come to an understanding of His purpose. Time to get our lives in order and adjusted. God is long-suffering. God is patient. God is kind. He deals with us gently. And now the people are going to see that in this ministry that is going to be presented to them. Because, you see, they're coming now to this time when Elisha is going to foreshadow the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. Elisha is going to bring in the ministry of Jesus as a reality. Now you may say, well, would the people know that? Let's just think about this life of Elisha for a moment. He brought sight to the blind, for the young man could not see, and his eyes were opened that he might behold the power of God in the angelic host. He controlled the elements, even as our master did from the boat, as we read this morning. This man was able to reverse the elements and to cause the axe head to float. This man gave food to the hungry and took a little and made it feed a large number. This man, as we've already said, gave the people living waters that they might live abundantly. The chapter which we had read, 2 Kings chapter 4, this man provided the price of redemption. He did it by his power. And as we shall see tomorrow, this man cleansed the sin of Naaman through the waters of baptism. And as we shall see shortly, this man brought life where there was only death through the resurrection of a Shunammite woman's son. You see how in the life and ministry of Elisha, a time of 40 years, the kindness and the compassion, the long-suffering and the patience of God was brought before the people. And what they were being taught was, God will supply all your needs. That's what the miracles of victory are all about as we go through the life of Elisha. God will supply all your needs. It doesn't matter what circumstance you find yourself in. It doesn't matter what environment you find yourself in. It doesn't matter what the problem is that you face. God can supply all your needs. But it takes time to learn that lesson. You don't learn it overnight. You only learn it through the experiences of life, through the fellowship of your brethren and sisters, through the many struggles and wrestlings that we have to go through. It is not easy to learn that God can supply all our needs. because you see, sometimes we confuse our needs with our wants. That's the difference. God knows what we need, and sometimes that list is quite different from what we want. And so we come to that chapter we had read this morning, 2 Kings chapter 4. That particular miracle is a very dynamic one, really, isn't it? And it has many echoes of New Testament teachings by the Lord Jesus Christ. There cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets. Here we are now, we have sons of the prophets. We now have a family faith. You see, that's how God works, and that's why you need time. The truth is a family truth. It's a faith which spreads. Yes, one here, one there. And the one becomes a family. And the family grows. And the faith expands. And so we see it happening now in the ministry of Elisha. We have wives and sons of prophets. And where do they turn? When they have a problem, they turn to Elisha. My husband is dead. Thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord. And now the creditor is knocking on the door. What shall I do for thee? And Elisha waits for her answer. And she looks at what she's got. And you know, brothers and sisters, that's often the last thing we do. We're always very conscious of what we haven't got. You know, I haven't got this. I haven't got that. They've got more than me. If I had that facility, it would be different. If I was able to call on those resources, I could do much more. Forgive me, but I was just going to say, if only we had a vehicle, we could drive here and we could drive there. But you see, we are like that, aren't we, as human beings? We always look at what we haven't got. And what Elisha made this woman do is, well, what have you got that you can use? And she says, well, all I've got is a pot of oil. Well, all right, if that's all you've got, God will help you use what you've got. God can take you and what you've got, and he can put it to work for him. And he can do miraculous things with what you've got. This is still the age of miracles. God is actually working with us. I mean, just look at us. We're a motley crowd, aren't we? When you come to consider it. But the living God who created heaven and earth, sustains all life, brought the universe into being, has got plans that roll through eternity that we can't even comprehend, he's actually working with you and me. Well, if that's not a miracle, brothers and sisters, I don't know what is. You know, that's a living miracle that God has chosen to work with us, sinful men and women. So what have you got that you can give to God that he can then take with you and use? Wherever you go, whatever situation you find yourself in, you have got something that can be used in the service of God. That's the lesson. That's the miracle. And so he says, well, go, borrow every vessel you can find, knock up all your neighbours, take every can, every bowl, every jar, every jug, every container you can find, and bring it into the house. So there's the first act of faith. What am I going to do this for? What's the consequence going to be? What's the end result? Well, I don't know what the end result's going to be. So you start off in faith not knowing where you're going to end up. And that's what she did. And when you've come in, shut the door and start pouring what you've got into another vessel. And as they fill up, just keep pouring. Well, I don't know what the scene was like in that closed house with the door shut and the sons and the mother there, and they start to pour, and that's one, two, three, four, five, and you can imagine the excitement as it worked. as it happened. And the mother would be pouring, and she's saying, it's going, one, another one, another one, quick, quick. And she kept pouring, and she kept pouring and pouring until every receptacle was filled. See, what you've got can be given to somebody else. That's the lesson you learn. What you've got can come out and out and out. What you've got is not yours to keep, but it's yours to grow and expand. And all the parables teach us this, don't you? You don't wrap it in and bury it, but you make it work. And God will make it work for you, and God will give the increase. All the time, God gives the increase. And so she said to the man of God, I've filled everything. Can't move a foot in our house without bumping into something that's got oil in it. Go. Sell the oil, he says. Pay your debt. And what can you do as a consequence of paying your debt, brothers and sisters? Live. When God gets hold of you and takes what you've got and makes it grow and increase, that's when you really start living. You're dead up to then. You only live when God gives the increase. That's the only time you live, when God is working with you. When you say, this is what I've got, God, it's all I've got, but you can have it. Whatever it is in me that you see in me, use it. Pay the debt. Live thou and thy children on the rest. God supplies sufficient unto the day. God will always supply. O ye of little faith. That's what Jesus says, doesn't he? God will always supply. God has provided, my beloved brothers and sisters, the means by which the debt can be paid. He has provided the price. God has given us the payment. For he has given us his only beloved Son, in whom he was well pleased. And the price has been paid. And he says, go, live. Live. Live in Christ. That's what we have to do, brothers and sisters. You know, he's taken us with what we thought was nothing. And he's made it grow and increase into a great abundance for him. And the debt's been paid. And now we can live. Now we can live unto the Lord. And as you look down through the miracles of Elisha's ministry, these are the lessons that get repeated time and time again. In this same chapter, we have the instance of the poisoned pot, don't we? Where they cry out because the food is contaminated. And they come to the prophet, and the prophet throws in the meal, and he turns it into living bread that they might eat and not die. We have the man who's busy chopping wood. Now, you see, the sons' schools of the prophets, they're expanding. I mean, he comes along and he says, the place isn't big enough now, we've got to build a bigger place. This is the work of grace. This is the effect of years of toil. We need a bigger hall, because there's more of us. Well, we need an axe to cut the wood. I'll borrow an axe, and then the head comes off, and it goes in the water, and it sinks. And the man's distraught, because it's not his axe. He's got to give it back, and he can't. It's down at the bottom of the water. And there it comes, floating up to the surface. And the hand can reach out and take it. You see, all things are possible with God. When Jesus stilled the storm, you know, with a voice, even the wind and waves obeyed him. God actually does perform miracles. Now, I said, didn't I, at some stage, we're not a sort of testimonial people when we started talking about angels. But I said, if you all look back in your life, you can see incidents where the angels have worked in your life. Where there have been definite things that have taken place which on reflection you can attribute to the hand of God at work in your life. Now, I can tell you where the miraculous happened in our ecclesia. When another brother and I went into a house and we said, yes, we'll buy this house for the old folks. We will pay you £165,000, because she wanted a lot more, but when she heard what we wanted it for, she was prepared to let us have it. And we came out the door and we looked at each other and we didn't have a penny. We did not have a penny. We'd never even started to put the thing together at that stage. But we'd looked here and we'd looked there and the doors didn't seem to open, and this door just opened and we'd gone through it. And we were 250 yards from the meeting room. It was everything that you could possibly ask for. And so we said, it, God is telling us to do it, so we'll do it. So we came out and we didn't have a penny, brethren and sisters. Not a penny. Well, I could have mortgaged the house again, I suppose, and we could have sold this, and we still wouldn't have got there. And within less than 3 months, not only could we buy the house, not only could we convert the house, not only could we furnish it in different ways, we had more money than we knew what to do with. Now you see, that's what God does in this age of miracles. He takes what you've got and he makes it grow. And it grows bigger and bigger if you put your trust in God. And these people had to learn to do it. The siege of Samaria, which we read about in 2 Kings chapter 6, is a typical one, isn't it? Just let's remind ourselves of the words of what happens in 2 Kings chapter 6. You know, the words of Elisha, in this. In fact, there's a lot of similarities between this story, this narrative, and the one of Naaman that we're going to be looking at tomorrow. Because you see, in this particular siege of Samaria, you've got leprosy, you've got silver and gold and clothing, you've got a man, Elisha, sitting in his house, you've got a messenger coming, you've got a king leaning on the arm of his commander, and of course you've got punishment on those who despise the word of God. And so there's a lot of similarities in this. But in fact, they're in dire straits. They're in real trouble with this siege, and their sort of cannibalism is starting to take place amongst the people. And so Elisha is there in his house in verse 32, and the elders are with him, and the king sends a messenger to him. Elisha says, don't even let this son of a messenger from the son of a murderer in. And while he's talking, the message comes that this evil's come from God, and why should we wait any longer for God to save us? And so he actually then goes on to talk about the blessings that will come at the beginning of chapter 7. And then you see the captain of the host says, behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, might this thing be. This thing where there shall be more flour than you know what to do with, more barley than you know what to do with. Things are going to change quite dramatically, almost overnight, in a way you can't imagine, says Elisha. And the captain says, God, nobody works like that. And it's the lepers who go out and find it, isn't it? The unclean, the outcasts. They go out, they find that the enemy have gone. And why is the enemy gone? Verse 6, for the Lord has made the host of the Syrians hear a noise of chariots, a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. Here's the angels at work. The angels have caused so much noise that the whole army has fled in fear. And so they go back and they tell the people of the city. And what happens? Well, verse 18, it came to pass as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, two measures of barley for a shekel and a measure of fine flour for a shekel shall be tomorrow about this time in the gates of Samaria. And that the Lord answered the man of God and said, now behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, might such a thing be? And he said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not eat thereof. And it fell out unto him, for the people trod him in the gates, and he died. When the people saw the enemy had gone and the siege was lifted and all that food and all those riches were there, they couldn't be held back and they stampede through the gate, and the poor chap who didn't believe that God could work in his life got trampled underfoot and died. Having lived through the siege, he didn't get any of the benefits of the siege being lifted. Now you see, that's the faith we have to have, brothers and sisters. That anything that seems impossible, with God it's possible. But you only learn it through being patient, gentle, long-suffering, kind and compassionate. Give God time to work in your life. God's time scale is not our time scale. That's the thing that we have to learn with these particular events that come about. God's time scale isn't ours. Miracles still happen. This is the age of miracles. And he will work in our lives. And he will teach us the lessons that he wants us to learn. We just have the patience to go through these experiences and appreciate what God is telling us. So let's go back to that fourth chapter which we had read, 2 Kings chapter 4. Because we're coming now to this incident with the Shunammite woman. This woman is a very special woman. You read verse 8, and it fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman, and she constrained him to eat bread. And so it was that as oft as he passed by, he turned in thither to eat bread. And she said unto her husband, Behold now, I perceive that this is an holy man of God, which passeth us by continually. Regularly. He's on a regular route. That's the one thing you learn when you serve God. There's got to be a consistency. This man trod a path and people got to know him. They got to rely on him. They came to realize that when they wanted him, they knew where they could find him. But it's that key phrase which comes three times in this chapter. Verse 8. And it fell on a day. Verse 11. And it fell on a day. Verse 18. It fell on a day. Put it into modern English. It just so happened. She didn't expect it. The day started out just like any other day. It just so happened. And when we least expect it, God often has to teach us very difficult lessons. And sometimes we don't feel prepared for them. But in his mercy and compassion, God knows best. And this woman has constrained the man of God. In verse 10, let us make a little chamber, I pray thee, on the wall, and let us set for him there a bed and a table and a stool and a candlestick, and it shall be when he cometh to us that he shall turn in thither. And so here we see the contrast between the royalty, the fine living of the people, and the sufficient unto the day thereof living of the prophet. He had a bed and a table, a stool and a candlestick. He had sufficient. It wasn't great riches, but it was all he needed. And she gave it to him. She could have given him more, no doubt, because they were very wealthy. They were landowners and farmers. This is the contrast that's presented to us. You know, when you look at Ahab, the man who gathered to himself horses and mules and then spent the time of the drought trying to provide for them and not the people. The king who wanted Naboth's vineyard and didn't like the fact that Naboth knew the law and said he wasn't allowed to give away his inheritance and allowed Jezebel, by deceit and lies, to murder. This is the difference. This is a materialistic age that we're living in here, in the times of Elijah and Elisha. And the drought's affecting people and it's making them more conscious of their possessions and what they haven't got and what they have got. And the drought comes again, you see. There's another 7-year drought that comes up in the lives of these people. But it fell on a day that he came thither, it says in verse 11, and he turned into the chamber and lay there. And he says to Gehazi, call this Shunammite. And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said unto her, say now unto her, behold, thou hast been careful for us with all this care. What is to be done for thee? Wouldest thou be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the host? And she answered, I dwell among mine own people. She was content. You notice that? I mean, here's a man who says, look, I can open all sorts of doors for you. I can do all sorts of things for you. I can put a good word in for you. I can make things happen that perhaps no one else can make happen for you in this land. I'm Elisha, the man of God. And she says, I'm very happy with the way I am, thank you. I've got all I need. Godliness with contentment, brothers and sisters, is great gain. This woman may have been well off materially, but she was rich. She had riches upon riches as far as her spiritual life was concerned. And so he talks to his servant. It's interesting, isn't it? The servant, you see, knew more. Verily, she hath no son. Her husband is old. Somehow the servants must have talked to each other, perhaps. The servants of the Shunammite woman and Gehazi, perhaps they sat in the kitchen chatting about life and the way things are and the gossip. And Gehazi's now found out that the one thing the woman would want was a child, but, you know, she's given that up. But you notice she didn't say that, did she? She didn't complain. Here's the same lesson. What have you got? I've got everything I need, thank you very much. It's not what I haven't got, I've got everything I need. And so, when Elisha hears this, he says, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the door. And he said, about this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son. And she said, nay, my lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thy handmaid. She didn't want her hopes lifted and then dashed. She was much more happy to be content and to stay as she was. And now we're going to have a repeat of Sarah, aren't we? Only this time, it's the husband who's past child-giving age. And obviously a miracle takes place. Life comes where there was no life. And so we're told the woman conceived and bare a son at that season of the time. And Elisha said unto her, it will happen. And so you see, it just so happened that he passed by and they started a relationship. It just so happened that he found out that she longed for a son and she conceived. And it says in verse 18, and when the child was grown, it fell on a day. It just so happened. And sunstroke hits the child, and the father, who had given him life, is unable to do anything for him. The father is totally helpless in this situation. He can't do anything. And the child sits upon his mother's knee and finally dies. And what did she do? She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door on him. She called her husband, said, fetch me a servant, fetch me one of the donkeys. And he says, well, why are you going off to the holy man? It's not a religious occasion, it's not a feast day, it's not a Sabbath. She says, don't you mind, I'm away. Here is this woman's faith, and she goes. Now, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Verse 25, so she went and came unto the man of God to Mount Carmel. There he was. That's interesting, isn't it? He was on Mount Carmel. You see, it doesn't hurt us, brothers and sisters, to revisit. It doesn't hurt us to revisit, because that's where our memories are strongest. That's where we get our strength from. And there on Carmel, where the people had said, Yahweh is God, where the living fire had come down from heaven and accepted the burnt offering, and the sins of the people had been forgiven, there on Carmel, where God had shown his power and his strength, was to be found this man of God. And it came to pass, when the man of God saw her afar off, that he said to Gehazi, behold, yonder is that Shunammite. I wonder, you know, this is the power of the Spirit, I'm presuming, that he could see her and recognise afar off. It's a New Testament parable, isn't it? They're looking into the distance, waiting, looking for that person who's coming, is the man of God. So he sends his servant. Is it well with thee? Is it well with thy husband? Is it well with the child? And she says it's well, and she's not going to tell him anything. She's only got one concern, and that is to get to the man of God. And she comes up and she throws herself at his feet and catches at his robe. The servant, concerned, wants to drag her away. Elisha says, let her alone, for her soul is vexed, and the Lord hath hid it from me and has not told me. And so she then unburdens herself. And you see what she says in verse 30, and the mother of the child said, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. Here is this woman's acknowledgement. Here's that phrase, that expression again, as the Lord liveth. She lived and moved and had her being in the presence of the living God. She knew she walked and talked, and that her whole life was encompassed by God and his angels. And she couldn't go through and turn her back, this experience, and turn her back on God. And so Elisha comes to this child. Verse 33, he went, he shut the door upon them, and prayed unto the Lord, and he went and lay upon the child, and put his mouth upon his mouth, and his eyes upon his eyes, his hands upon his hands, and he stretched himself upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. And then he walked to and fro, and the child sneezes, and the child opens his eyes. Now, the woman would have known about Zarephath, wouldn't she? She would know that here was the man in whom the spirit of Elijah now rested. She would know that Elijah had brought the son of the widow of Zarephath back to life, and now she comes and asks for this same thing to be done for her. And here is a lesson. It's a lesson for the nation, and it's a lesson for the woman. It's a lesson for the prophet. You see how he embraces the child, where the living take unto them the dead, and the dead become alive. And when you come to Hebrews chapter 11, it actually tells you why this resurrection took place. Now, God willing, when we at Westville, we should be expanding in other ways on this verse in Hebrews chapter 11. But in Hebrews chapter 11 at verse 34, it says that these worthies of old quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. And then it says, women received their dead raised to life again. Now, what is this chapter about? It's a chapter which shows us that from the time of the beginning, from Abel onwards, people had a faith in resurrection from the dead. That's what all this chapter is about. It weaves its way down through the history of the nation, showing that this man, this woman, this man, this woman, they had faith in resurrection from the dead. Abraham received him in like figure back from the dead. The whole chapter is about faith in resurrection from the dead. And this is telling us that the two women, the woman at Zarephath and the Shunammite woman, they understood resurrection from the dead. And to understand resurrection from the dead, they must have understood the sacrificial work of the Lord Jesus Christ. She received her dead back to life. And the Gentile woman in Zarephath and the Jewish woman in Shunam gave living witness in the ministry of Elijah and Elisha to the fact that there is only one God, who is patient and kind, long-suffering and gentle. There is one God who can pay the debt that has to be paid and create a miracle by bringing life where there is only death. And so the woman has her son restored to her. Take up thy son. And she took up her son and she went out. Now, brothers and sisters, it happened on a day. It just happened. And that's how life is. But our faith in the God of life The God who has created life and sustains life must never waver.
And we must never take life for granted in that sense. But we must remember
the words of James.
A lot of lessons in James that link to the times of Elijah and Elisha.
Ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor. It appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now you rejoice in your boasting. All such rejoicing is evil. There is only one thing that we can rejoice in, and that is, it matters not what falls upon the day, because we are in the hands of the living God.